Thank you so much for being here again today. We'll start right back in Daniel chapter 5 where we were. You've been so faithful to be here, and I'm grateful for that and grateful for the new friends that I've made this week. Well, in Daniel chapter 5, Belshazzar, which would be a grandson to Nebuchadnezzar, takes over the throne. And you remember, the Persians have come in 50 miles north, and they've overtaken what would be modern-day Baghdad. They're absolutely taking control. And Belshazzar, probably because it's a regular festival season in Babylon, he's having a big party with 1,000 guests, and they're drinking each other under the table. And he says, hey, I got an idea. Somebody go get the gold and the silver goblets that were the Jews and bring them out. And there he is with his wives, his friends, his concubines. They take the gold and the silver goblets of God, and they begin to drink out of them, make light of them. In fact, they even make a toast to idols, to the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood and stone. And so here they are taking the holy goblets of God and making a toast to the gods that are idols. Remember Isaiah the prophet in Isaiah 52 had said, the guys who carry the golden goblets of God had to be clean, touch nothing unclean, go out of the midst of her, purify yourselves, those who carry the vessels of the Lord. So, as some Old Testament scholars said, with the temple already being destroyed, these goblets of God were the last remnant of Israel's religion. It's all they had left. And Nebuchadnezzar, on his worst day, would have never defiled those holy goblets. He stole them. He didn't mind having the gold in his treasury, but he would not have taken and toasted to the pagan gods like his grandson Belshazzar did. Now, your translation calls Belshazzar calls Nebuchadnezzar his father. The word actually is ancestor. It doesn't say father at all. And when you line it up, it's actually his grandfather. Now remember, between Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, there are four other Babylonian kings that the book of Daniel doesn't address. Nebuchadnezzar had a 43-year reign, and those between all together, those four, only had a 12-year reign. So they were coming and going pretty quickly until we get to Belshazzar, and we find ourselves actually at the end of his reign as he's throwing the big party on the eve of his destruction. Well, all of a sudden, at the party, when Belshazzar is drinking himself on the table, he's drinking out of the gold goblets, a hand appears and it begins to write on the wall. Now, it's pretty clear that this is a divine occurrence because, remember Belshazzar, he turns pale as he could be, his knees start knocking and his hip joints get loose. He loses bodily function. He is as nervous as he can be. And the writing on the wall, he must know what this writing means. Well, I told you last time they'd actually found this Babylonian throne room, this palace here, and the wall with white gypsum that they think might actually be the wall. This is all the way back in 1899 that this Babylonian room was found. And any writing by God would have shown up very easily. Now, it doesn't say it's the finger of God, but think about your Old Testament stories. In Exodus 31, God's finger wrote the Ten Commandments, the finger of God. You remember what happened after the plagues? The Egyptian magician said, these works are the works of the fingers of God. And finally, the psalmist himself declares that the heavens themselves are the work of God's fingers, Psalm 8. Well, the king, his face grows white, his mind goes mad, his knees start knocking, his bodily functions are beyond his control, and he calls, verse 7, the Salesian sages. If you were trying out for a play for the narrative parts of Daniel, you know, the easiest thing to be is say, hey, I'll be one of the magicians or soothsayers of the Babylonians. Because what do? You go, I don't know. I'll throw out the whole book. Hey, what does this mean, guys? You've been trained? I don't know. All I got to be able to say is, I don't know. What does the handwriting on the wall mean? They ask the king. The king asks them, and they reply, I don't know. Now we're caught up to where we left off last time. Enter the queen. Look at verse 10. The queen entered the banquet. Because of the words of the king and his nobles, the queen spoke and said, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. Now, who is this queen? Is it just another wife of Belshazzar? I don't think so. His wives and his concubines are already there. This is bigger than that. This is most likely, Josephus says, his grandmother, one of Nebuchadnezzar's wives. So she is the queen mother. She's been around a long time. Whoever she is old enough to remember this old guy named Daniel. Daniel now is old, maybe 80 years old. Way back to Nebuchadnezzar's reign, the early days. So the queen remembers, hey, don't worry, don't let your face grow pale. There is a guy in whom dwells the spirit of the gods. And your grandfather, Neb, he had a dream, called Daniel. Daniel could tell him what it meant. She has absolute 100% confidence in Daniel. Been there, done that, seen that. She knew that Daniel could deliver the dream. So probably Neb's wife, the queen mother. Besides, you know, from the book of Esther, were wives allowed just to walk into the king's? Nope. If she just walked in, we learn from Esther that she probably would have lost her life unless she's your grandmother and she's telling you what to do. So there you go. That's what's happening here. Daniel by now is almost a forgotten figure of the story. The queen remembered that Daniel was confident and could solve the mystery, that he had all wisdom, all insight, and he knew all things. Look at verse 11. There's a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of your father, remember I'm saying grandfather, illumination, insight, wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Neb, your grandfather, the king, appointed him. He was chief of the magicians, the conjurers, and Chaldeans and diviners. Because he had an extraordinary spirit, it didn't matter. What she says in verse 12 is, whatever the puzzle, Daniel could solve it. Whatever the puzzle, Daniel could solve it. Well, Belshazzar, now remember, not Belteshazzar. Belteshazzar is Daniel. Belshazzar is the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king here. Well, Belshazzar makes an offer. Then Daniel was brought before the king. The king spoke to Daniel. Are you Daniel, who's one of the exiles from Judah, whom my grandfather, the king, brought from Judah? Well, this is a masterful literary play. Now, I told you, as odd as it was and as mean and as nasty as Neb was, I always kind of felt like Daniel liked him. He always helped him out and told him what he needed to know. And I kind of think Neb liked Daniel, too. It's kind of an odd relationship, right? I don't think Belshazzar and Daniel have that enemy-friend relationship. I don't think Daniel cares for him all, and Belshazzar obviously doesn't show Daniel the respect. Here's a guy who's pale of face, knees knocking, and he says, hey, aren't you just one of those slaves we brought? Didn't you come out of Judah? Aren't you an exile? Didn't my grandfather drag you out and defeat you? What a way to start a conversation. I know who you are, boy. Let me put you in your place. Let's go another level deeper. The fact that Daniel is brought out of Jerusalem is just like the goblets that were brought out of Jerusalem. I think there's a play here. Aren't you just like the goblets I defiled? I think the reader wants you to see that Daniel, like the goblets, has come out of Jerusalem and he's defiled the goblets, and now he's belittling Daniel in the story. Now he says in verse 15, I brought out the conjurers for the Chaldeans and they don't know anything. I don't know. That's all they say. But I've heard about you, verse 16, that you're able to give interpretations. Tell me what it means. And if you do, you get three things. You'll be clothed in purple. You wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you'll be the third man in the land. Remember, his father had just gotten defeated by the Persians, was on the run, but technically father's still alive. His father was the co-king with him, at least at this point. And so it would be his father, Nabonidus, and then Belshazzar, and then Daniel would be third. If you tell me what this means, this handwriting on the wall, you will be the third in all the land. Now think about this. If the Persians have just come down 50 miles away, and they're about to whip your honey, southern expression, do you want to be wearing gold and purple around when they get there? Do you want to be third in command when they're about to destroy the kingdom? I mean, do you want to be, you don't want to be the third pilot on a plane that's going down? Daniel says, now, Daniel has other noble reasons. Daniel can't be bought. Daniel says, look at verse 17, keep your gifts for yourself or give them to somebody else. But I will tell you what the dream means. Daniel deals with this megalomaniacal monarch in a much more terse fashion than he did Neb. You remember whenever we talked to Neb, he'd say, King, you're great and you're something and whatever you say happens and even the birds and the beasts, they obey you. He used a little flattery with Neb for whatever reason. There's no flattery with Belshazzar. He doesn't like the guy. The guy just told him, I know who you are. You came out of Jerusalem. And so keep your gifts to yourself. I think he says it kind of tersely. By now he's 80 years old. What's he care, you know? Keep your gifts to yourself. O King, the Most High God, granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty. To who? Your grandfather, Neb. And then he tells him the story. And here's the odd thing that I told you yesterday. He tells him the story. Your grandfather had a big ego. God blessed him. Whoever he wanted to kill, he could kill. Whomever he wanted to spare, he could spare. Whoever he wanted to elevate, he could elevate. Whomever he wanted to humble, he could humble. Your grandfather had it going, but he got arrogant before God, and God turned him into a beast, and he ran with the wild donkeys. This is where the word donkey is introduced in our story in Daniel. And he says, and you knew all these things, and yet you're dealing with all this pride. You knew these things. Look at verse 22. Yet you, his grandson, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this. History has a way of repeating itself, doesn't it? We just have the same cycles over and over again. Remember I said there's two ways to get an education in life. One is to let somebody else pay the tuition, let them make mistakes, watch their fumbles and their faults, and you say, I'm not going to do that. They're drinking too much, destroys their family. I'm not going to touch that. Watch what other people do. Learn, let them pay the tuition, and you learn. The second way is to say, I won't learn from anybody else's mistakes. I insist on making all the mistakes myself, and I'll pay the tuition. Put Belshazzar in the second category. You knew what happened to your grandfather, and yet you acted just as he has acted, even though you knew all of this. Well, then he gives him the interpretation. What you've been waiting for here, many, many tekel upharsin. That's what's written on the wall. Many, many tekel upharsin. There are three different nouns. They're used as verbals here. Oddly enough, but there are three different nouns that have to do with the meaning and measure of money. The meaning and the measure of money. Many means to be numbered. So it's numbered, weighed, divided. You, Belshazzar, your king of Babylonian, you have been numbered. You have been numbered. Your days are numbered. Yeah, they're numbered. The Persians are already camping and making their way down. You have been weighed in the balance. And you have been found wanting, and you are divided. Your kingdom will be given to another. Many, many twice to elevate the importance, the punch of it. Now, there is an interesting change here. Many, many tekel upharsin. So you can write down numbered, weighed, divided. But when we go to interpret it, look at verse 26. And this is the interpretation of the message. Many, God has numbered your kingdom and put it to an end. Tekel, you've been weighed in the scales and found deficient. Perez, now wait, I thought it was supposed to be upharsin. Many, many tekel upharsin, and now we have Perez. Perez is a singular form of parson. So it's the same word. It's just a singular form. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Singular form of Parson Perez, and that's why he makes the switch. Now, all the wise men, the magicians, the conjurers, or the Chaldeans could not come up with this interpretation, or maybe they didn't want to tell Belshazzar what it meant. Here's a word play here. I think the reason he switches to Perez is this. Farsin was what was written on the wall, but you know that Aramaic and Hebrew scripts have no vowels. Now, that's tough reading. It's just all the consonants. Imagine if you were reading a book and when we took out all the vowels and you had to just fill the vowels in your head by context to find the meaning of the word. Well, if you take out all the vowels of Perez and you put it in the Aramaic text, it's the same word as Persia. It's the same word as Persia. And where are the Persians right now? Well, I told you, when we started a few minutes ago, they were 50 miles away. Now they're about 20 miles away. Just in my little short talk, they have traveled 30 miles. They are on the move. So I think Daniel's a prophet. That's a beautiful prophecy. So he takes the word Pharos and makes it Perez, changes it to mean the Persians are knocking at your door. 29, we have the fall of Babylon. Then Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple, put a necklace of gold around his neck, and issued a proclamation concerning him that now he was the authority of third in the kingdom. Well, I thought he said he wasn't going to take any of that. Well, he wouldn't be bought. If you're going to give me that to get me to say what you want me to say, I won't take it. So the interpretation was given with the understanding he wanted nothing. I think probably Belshazzar insisted that he receive it in order that God would give him some mercy. He's trying to buy God off, and just like he tried to buy Daniel off. And I imagine Daniel didn't go parading around with gold and purple with the Persians knocking at the door. Though we'll find he did become friends of the Persians as well. The fall of Babylon. Now, we've got this down pretty close. The fall takes place October the 11th, 539 BC. There are not many biblical events that you can date like that. That's because there are a lot of ancient historians like the Nabonidus Chronicle that actually give us the dates of these occurrences. So we're right. The banquet is on the 12th, October the 12th. He's drinking. He's using the golden goblets on the 12th. And he gets ashen when he sees the handwriting on the wall. And next thing you know, the next day, the Persians show up and take over the city. Look at this, verse 30. That same night, I told you they were close. The Persians were close. That same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. Now, how in the world did they get into the city? Remember, Neb, the grandfather, built all these fortifications. He had walls double thick, 43 feet thick. There was no way to get into to Babylon like this. There's no way to attack it. Well, the Persians were smart. They took the water and diverted it. And they went through the tunnel, the water pipe. And so they diverted the water. They couldn't get through the wall, so they diverted the water, let the water level go down. And now, how are the Babylonians, what kind of shape are they in? They've been drinking all night. They've been having their party. The Persians just walk in through the water tunnel. They just walk through the pipe and say, surprise, surprise. And guess how they're greeted? The citizens say, man, we're so glad you're here. We hate Belshazzar. All these people in Babylon had been brought from other countries that had been exiles. Like the Jews were exiles, there were other exiles, and the exiles thought, maybe these folks will let us go back home. In fact, guess what? They do. So there's not even a fight. They walk through the tunnel. There's no fight. They kill the king. They take over. And it seems like the citizens actually welcome them. Numbered, weighed, divided. The Cyrus Cylinder, an archaeological fact, says the city was captured without battle. Chapter 6, our last chapter of the narrative material of Daniel. Daniel in the lion's den. One thing we'll talk about at the very end is, who is this Darius? I do want to tell you up front, there is no extra biblical attestation to a guy by the name of Darius anywhere. None, zero. Now, does that worry me? No, it doesn't. I'll argue at the end that he and Cyrus are the same guy. There was no extra-biblical attestation to anybody named Belshazzar. In fact, people used to say, Belshazzar, king of Babylon. There's no record of that. That's one of the eras of the Bible. And then guess what? There were some archaeological facts found that said there was a king named Belshazzar. And now it's one of the greatest attested facts of the Bible, that Belshazzar is the name. So we may find over the next tablet or cylinder and find that indeed there that Cyrus was sometimes called Darius. But again, it doesn't really matter. Darius tossing Daniel in the lion's den must surely be the best story, known story in all the Old Testament. Even a toddler can tell you about what? Daniel and the lion's den. But let's take a closer look. It seemed good to Darius, chapter 6, to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they should be in charge of the whole kingdom. And over them were three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one. And these satraps might be accountable to them, that the king might not suffer loss. And this Daniel began to distinguish himself among the commissioners and the satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Satrap is a word that means protector of the kingdom. That'd be used in different ways, but protector of the kingdom. And the commissioners over the satraps, so that the king might not suffer loss. It's all about the what? Money, the taxes. So the satraps make sure that the tax collectors aren't cheating in their area. And then the satraps report the commissioners. The commissioners make sure that the satraps aren't cheating, that the king is getting all the taxes into his treasury. It's a system. This is the IRS system. You can write nearby right there. IRS system. That's what's happening here in these first few verses of Daniel. Now apparently, and I think not oddly, the new ruler, Darius, is acquainted with Daniel. Why wouldn't he be? Daniel had been a very important government official in Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. He was the wisest guy in all the land. Darius didn't need to make an enemy out of Daniel. He knew Daniel, and he respected Daniel. But once again, in the narrative portions of Daniel, jealousy about the Judean captives and their elevation to places of prominence causes tension in the text. The locals start looking around, and they don't like that not only is Daniel one of the three commissioners, he is rising above the other commissioners. So they notice how well Daniel's doing, and they're trying to find a way to do Daniel in. Look at verse 4. The commissioners and satraps began trying to find grounds and accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs, but they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption could be found in him. These men said, "We should not find any ground of accusation against Daniel unless we find it against him in regard to the law of his God." Then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement. And the text says they came thronging. It's kind of a confused. They just run in there shouting to the king. They come by agreement. They come thronging to the king and spoke to him as follows. "King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom." What they're saying is, "We've had a little meeting and we love you so much. We think that anybody who, just for 30 days, anybody who prays to any man or God other than you, you know how great you are, Darius. Anybody who prays to any man or God other than you, well, they should be thrown into the lion's den." That's verse 7. "O king, establish forever according to the law of the Medes and the Persians." Now, are the laws of the Medes and Persians really flexible? No. If a Persian king, a Median king, if he makes a law, he has to obey it himself. Think about the book of Esther. In that case, the law of the Medes and Persians could not, the king had to let them attack the Jews because he had already made the edict that they could. So we're reminded about three times in this text that the law of the Medes and the Persians cannot be changed. That's why it's important to get Darius to sign the fact that whoever prays to any god other than Darius or any man other than Darius will be thrown into the lion's den. Verse 9. Therefore, King Darius signed the document, that is, the injunction. Now, I want you to notice one interesting thing about Daniel. He was beyond reproach. These guys are his enemies. And they say, we're not going to find anything. He never cooks the books. He always tells the truth. He's a righteous man. Whatever we find on Daniel has to be in regard to his religion. That made me think when I read that text, what would my enemies say about me? Do we live life in such a way that even our enemies would have to say, I don't like him? I don't like him at all. But he's a person of integrity. That's what they had to say. We don't like Daniel. We don't like Daniel at all. But we will find, you can audit the books backwards and forwards and up and down. You will find nothing wrong with Daniel. No treason, no treachery. Daniel has been faithful to Darius. Now, this lion's den could have been man-made. It could have been a natural cave. It doesn't make any difference. It's actually been discovered that Assyrians and Persians would capture lions, and they would cage them up, and then they would let them out for a hunt for the kings. So it was a sports thing. So that's why would they have lions? Well, they had lions so that the royal family could hunt lions, let them out and hunt them down. They'd capture more and breed them and just keep some lions that they could be hunted. It's a big sport industry even way back then. Well, we'll see what happens to Daniel. Now, when Daniel knew the document was signed, he entered the house of his roof chamber. He had a window open toward Jerusalem. And he continued kneeling on his knees three times a day, praying, give thanks before his God, as he had been previously doing. Man, if you didn't think much of Daniel before this study, I hope you see who he is here. You know what I would have said? I'm just being honest. I said, you know, for 30 days, I can just go in my inner closet and do my praying. That's what I would have said. No need to stir things up. I got things going good. I'm one of the three commissioners. In fact, I'm kind of the best of the three. Oh, just for 30 days. This is not, I would have told myself, this is not the same as bowing down to a statue on the plain of Dura. This is not that. Just going in my closet and praying, that's not the same as bowing down to a pagan statue. I wouldn't do that. Or I could just say, you know, Lord, for 30 days, I'm just going to skip my prayers and I'll pick back up in 30 days. What would you have done? I'm not convinced that I would have done what Daniel did. Daniel said, I know it's been signed. I know I'm going to be in big trouble. I know I'm going in the lion's den. Here he is, 80-year-old man getting on his knees, praying toward Jerusalem three times a day, leaves his window open. He didn't change it. He wasn't inviting trouble. He just did what he had always done. Daniel is consistent. Now, we have the comment here that he faced Jerusalem when he prayed. There's really nothing that demands Jews face Jerusalem when they pray. We do have 1 Kings 8, which says, when the heavens are shut up and there's no rain because they have sinned against thee, when they pray toward this place. So apparently there was some emphasis on praying toward Jerusalem, though it was not a requirement. In fact, by now, where's the temple? It's not there. But has the temple not being there ever stopped Jews from wanting to be close to where the temple was, or portions still are? No. So he faces towards Jerusalem, remembering that it is the God of Jerusalem that is his God. And then three times a day, there's no law that says Jews have to pray three times a day, but the psalmist says in Psalm 55, evening, morning, and noon, I will pray to you. So there are some Old Testament allusions or references to facing Jerusalem when you pray as a Jew and doing it three times a day, though these were not necessarily a requirement in any way. Well, now knowing Daniel was a faithful monotheist, that he could only worship God, that he couldn't pray to the king, couldn't make a request to the king, the conniving commissioners and satraps found Daniel just like they had expected. So they run and they take the news to Darius. Look at verse 11. These men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. They approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Did you not sign an injunction? And look what the king says at the end of verse 12. The statement is true. According to the law of the Medes and the Persians, meaning there's nothing I can do to change it. Well, one of the exiles from Judah, see, that's pejorative language. One of these foreigners, one of these folks you brought in and you elevated over us, the locals. One of these exiles from Judah has been caught doing exactly this. Verse 14, as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. In fact, he stayed up till sunset, kept exerting himself, trying to rescue him. Is there some clause somewhere in the bottom of the contract of the law that I signed? Is there some way I can get out of putting Daniel in the lion's den? Daniel is my wisest guy in all the land. He's the best of my commissioners. Is there any way out of this? He realizes that he has been tricked. He's distressed, number one. He's about to lose the wisest man in the land. He's distressed, number two, because his own ego placed him in an irrevocable dilemma against Daniel. He let his ego, they played on his ego, people can only pray to you. He must have been angered, thirdly, because of these conniving commissioners who have manipulated the monarch into doing harm to his choice administrator. Well, in 16 through 21, the king doesn't sleep a bit that night. He does throw Daniel in the lion's den. And what he says in verse 16, Daniel, the God whom you, look at that, sporadically serve? Nope. The God whom you continually serve will himself deliver you. The God whom you continually serve will deliver you. The stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the cave. The king seals it with his own ring, the wax, so nobody can break it till the morning. The king goes off to his palace and sleeps well. No, he doesn't sleep well. He turns and he tosses. He's fast at night. No entertainment. In other words, no one from the harem comes to see the king that night. His sleep fled him. He's tossing and turning. In fact, you know, you've had those nights when you long for the morning to see how bad the damage is. And when he awakens, what does the king do? A very unkingly thing. He shouldn't care about an exile, no matter how he is in the land. He runs. The king is running all the way to the lion's den. And he says, verse 21, Daniel, servant of the living God. Notice, not the God of stone or wood, but the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, has he been able to deliver you from the lions? I think old Daniel paused just a minute right there. He has a stone pulled back. He's thought about it all night long, thought he'd never get there that morning. Hey, Daniel, has your God been able to deliver you? It's echoing down the cave. Has your God been able to deliver you? I think Daniel pauses just a moment. It makes a lot better dramatic effect, doesn't it? And he says, what? O king, live forever. My God is able. My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth. And they have not harmed me inasmuch as I was found innocent before him and also toward you, O king. I have committed no crime. I've done nothing wrong before my God. I've done nothing wrong before you, O king. O king, live forever. God sent an angel, reminds us of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and the fourth man in the fiery furnace. God has sent an angel to shut the mouths of the lion. You remember what the author of Hebrews says in Hebrews 11? By faith, God's people conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, and quenched the power of fire. Hebrews puts these two together, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and the Daniel in the lion's den. By faith, the lion's mouths were shut, and the power of fire was quenched. Daniel is faithful. Well, the end of the story gets kind of nasty. This is the part we never tell the kids. So if you want to tell, if you tell the kids, if you do this in kids' church, you don't say. Then the king went and he got the guys that accused Daniel and came up with a law, and he threw them and their kids in the lion's den. And before they hit the ground, the lion caught them in midair and crushed their bones. Not a good thing for a children's sermon. But that's the way it ends. Now, before you say, how could the lions devour these manipulators? How can this be? Well, why is that even part of the story? It's part of the story because if the lions don't eat somebody, then the reader could assume they were hungry, right? Well, for you, these guys that do the alligator tricks in Florida, man, they feed those things so many chicken breasts before you ever mess with that alligator. He's just full. He's not going to mess with anybody. The lions were not full. They were starving. They were hungry. You throw in some meat and they will crush the bones before it hits the ground. Now, God did not order the children to be thrown into the lion's den. This is a pagan king who has made this decision. As Westerners, we're bothered by any kind of communal punishment. But the prophets themselves, like Prophet Jeremiah, Jeremiah 31, Ezekiel 18, spoke against this practice of punishing families for the sins of the father. But that's what happens in this text. Would your enemies testify that you're above reproach? Could they? Is your religious fervency so much part of your DNA that you're going to be at church every week, every Sunday? You have your quiet time every day, that just like Daniel, it's such a rhythm of your life, like the Sabbath rhythm, that they know where you're going to be on God's day. Is your worship as rhythmic as Daniel's? Good questions. All right, let's look at the end. Then verse 26, I made a decree that in all my dominion of the kingdom, men are to fear and tremble the God of Daniel, for he is the what kind of God? The living God. He called him the living God in verse 20 as well. The enduring forever, and his kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed. Now remember that, his kingdom, unlike all kingdoms before, unlike the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Greeks and the Romans and well, back up to here where we are now, the Persians and the Medes, his kingdom is forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and earth, and who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lion's den. So this Daniel enjoyed success during the reign of Darius. Now, if you have a new King James Version, which I don't have in my hands, it reads this way. So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius. That is the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So the New King James Version takes, as I do, Darius and Cyrus to be the same person. So this Daniel enjoyed success during the reign of Darius. That is the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Everybody identifies Cyrus II, Cyrus the Great of Persia, 600 to 530 BC, has taken the city of Babylon. And I argue that this person is the same person as Darius the Mede. We know that Cyrus was about 62 when he took Babylon, around 60, and how old were we told in chapter 5 that Darius was? Chapter 5, 31, 62. They're the same age. The ages match up. We also know through family and marriages that Cyrus was related to the Medes, and that Cyrus and Darius are actually titles and not names. And so if you're ruling both the Persians and the Medes, you would have a title for the Persians, you'd have a title for the Medes. And so it makes sense that Darius, the Mede, would be the title, the same person, Cyrus, the Persian. At the end of the day, does it really matter? No. He could have been the general, could have not been the king, doesn't matter. But I think there's a really, really strong case, and the New King James Version has picked up on it. In fact, in the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament, they changed Darius to Cyrus right there in the text. So ancient interpreters of the Septuagint, which of course comes later than the Hebrew text, they were so convinced way back then that Darius and Cyrus are the same person that they just struck out the name Darius and they wrote the name Cyrus. And so again, they corrected a problem for the readers saying, who in the world is Darius? Okay, turn back to Daniel chapter 1. We're going to go through the first six chapters in 3 minutes. You are such experts now. Watch how easy this goes. You're going to have the flow of the narrative of Daniel, and you're going to love Daniel because you know it so well now. The third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, 605, the first year of Neb becoming king, Jehoiakim, king of Judah, he has not been obedient to God, and he's going to be punished. And so the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into the hand of Neb the first year. He's king of Babylon, and he goes and he looks for some men that are good looking, that are perfect. He takes away the best and brightest leaders and exiles them away to Babylon. And then Daniel's among those. And the king provides them rich food and wine to drink. And Daniel says, hey, me and my friends are just going to eat fruits and vegetables and drink water if you don't mind. And the guy says, I don't know. I might get my head cut off. This is what the king has ordered for you to eat. You're supposed to grow up in the kingdom and be a leader. And he says, give us 10 days. And God put it in his mind to give them 10 days. Give us 10 days. 10 days later, Daniel and his friends look the very best. And in fact, we are told as a foreboding text that Daniel alone was given the gift from God to interpret dreams and visions. Chapter 2, second year, Daniel's still in the Chaldean college, his second year of training. Neb has a terrible dream about the statue with a head of gold all the way down to the feet of iron and clay. And we wonder who this could be and what this means. And he calls all of his conjurers up if they would be able to tell him what it is. And they are the know-nothing conjurers. And they say, we have no idea what this means. And they're going to kill all the magicians, the soothsayers. And Daniel says, wait, don't kill them. He tells Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to pray for him. God gives him the dream. He goes and tells Neb, you saw a golden statue. He describes it beautifully, says these are all the kingdoms. Then we have that very interesting verse in chapter 2 where we find out they have the statue and the stone that was cut without human hands, the stone that has no beginning, that it strikes this statue, this ominous foreboding statue. It strikes it at the feet, but even the gold head, the silver arms, they all turn into powder and they are chaff in the wind. And the stone, which no man created, a representation of God, this stone becomes a mountain and is a kingdom that will never end. How does it end in chapter 6? You worship the God whose kingdom will never end. This stone, we argued, was the Christ. As we are, all the allusions to Jesus being the stone, we'll look at that here at the very end. Chapter 3, we have the golden image, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego on the plain of Dura. They are told to fall down and worship. They refuse to worship. They say, heat up the fire 7 times hotter. And they're thrown in there, and you know the end of that story. There's the fourth figure, maybe the Christ, maybe an angel. We can't know for sure, and they are spared. Chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar has another dream. They call up the Chaldeans. They can't interpret it. He tells them the dream. There's this great tree. Remember, this great tall tree. It represents Neb. It represents his power. The birds are in there. The beasts eat the fruit below. And then an angel comes and chops down the tree. And the birds and the beasts flee. An iron band is put around it. And all of a sudden, the stump becomes a man that becomes a beast that runs with the wild donkeys. And Neb says, what can this possibly mean? Daniel says, I told you not to be so arrogant. You need to repent. And for a whole year, he just struts around on his palace in his hanging guards and look what I've done. Look at all I've built. By now, he's older. He's at the end of his 43-year reign, and he's conquered every enemy. Kings are going to do two things if they have resources. They're going to wage war or build buildings. And he doesn't have anything else to do. He's built everything he can build, and he's conquered every enemy. He's bored, and then God sends him out as a beast, and then God restores him because he looks to heaven, and he is humbled. And then chapter 5, we just did, and chapter 6. In our last second, turn to Luke 20:18. Let's start in 17. Do you think Jesus didn't know the book of Daniel? This may be the greatest messianic allusion in the Gospel of Luke. For in the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. There's the statue with the golden head, silver arms, the bronze, the iron, the clay, the feet. In that story, we have statue and we have stone, and the stone, which we're told, is not made by hands. Remember, all things are either created or creator. That's the only division we have, ultimately, of all things. Either you created everything or you were created. And we're told this stone was not created, so this stone has to be divine. The stone has to be the creator. Therefore, it is God and thus the Christ. Look how well Jesus knew Daniel, these chapters you studied. But he looked at them and said, verse 17, "The stone which the builders rejected, this became the chief cornerstone. And everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces." And here's Daniel. "But on whomever it falls, it will scatter him like," what did Daniel say? "Dust. Dust." If anybody knew Daniel, when Jesus said that, they knew he was claimed to be the stone that would set up the kingdom that would never fail. He could have been crucified right there for claiming to be the stone, the creator, who would crush all the kingdoms and set up a kingdom that would never, ever fail. Kingdoms come and kingdoms go. But Lord, your kingdom. Let your kingdom come. And that kingdom began in the person and the birth of a Bethlehem baby. In fact, I told you, if you could summarize all the preaching of Jesus in one sentence, it is what? Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is what? At hand. It's here. The stone is here. Now we got to wait. First time he came as a Bethlehem baby, we got to wait. Next time he's come, he's not going to be a baby. He's going to have a sword in his mouth. And he will bring to full consummation the kingdom that will never, ever end. Thank you all for being here every day. Many of y'all were here every day, and you have now graduated. You are experts on the narrative chapters of Daniel. I went through that thing in about 3 minutes. You knew all of it, didn't you? Because you've been exposed to it. So you are now, I deem you experts in the narrative chapters of Daniel, and I appreciate some of you invested 5 hours into that, and I hope that these 5 hours that you invested, and you, every time you spend time learning God's word, it always comes back to bear fruit in your life, and it will bear fruit in your life. Hey, what a great week. Thanks for letting me be here, and thanks for new friendships, and always heard of this place and how special it was, but I get it now. I get it. God bless you and what you do, and thank you for holding forth traditions that most people have long, long forgotten. I know God will bless you and your work in the years to come. And let me close with a prayer. Oh God, what a special place and what a special people who gather here in this wilderness because they love you, because their great-grandmothers loved you, and they're passing down more than just cabins. They're passing down the legacy of the Lordship of Jesus. The stone that does the crushing that will never again be crushed. I pray for all the sermons that have been preached in this place, and we just reminisce of a room filled that indeed all the seeds planted will bear fruit for your kingdom. Thank you for your grace, your salvation, in the glory of our Christ. And in his name we pray. Amen.